Welcome. As we embark on the study of the Lankavatara Sutra, it's a 7-week class series, and we usually keep these series open, like people can drop in for one and drop out of one, or two, or three, or seven. But just to say at the outset, I think it's, if we want to really get into this, you know, it'll keep building on itself. So as much as possible, if people are up for doing like a whole class series, or say like 6 out of 7 classes, if that works for people, you'll, I think, receive more of the whole picture. As you know, a new translation of this sutra just came out by Red Pine, who is a wonderful translator, translated the Heart Sutra and Diamond Sutra and Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor and other Chinese poets. He's a Zen practitioner and scholar, practitioner I'd say foremost, and in the Chinese Zen tradition. So quite wonderful that he translated this in his creative, unique way with many notes. And as part of the causes and conditions of us studying this now, this is a sutra that was first translated by D.T. Suzuki in 1930, so way back, before anyone was maybe practicing Zen in America, but translated into English at that time. And I think in 1920, 10 years before that, he put out a whole book called Studies in the Lankavatara Sutra. So D.T. Suzuki, who many people know, I think, is one of the original Rinzai Zen teachers to really, more a scholar and a translator than a Zen teacher. But he, because he wrote all this stuff in English, he really, like, in a way, was responsible for bringing the understanding of Zen and the popularity of it to America in, like, the 50s. But these were, you know, this is a book he wrote in 1920. And then I think he was so into it, then he said, well, I thought, let's put out the translation of the whole book, too, which he did from, mostly from Sanskrit, even though, of course, he's Japanese. He looked at, like, 3 different Chinese translations, a couple Tibetan ones, and mostly the Sanskrit, whereas Red Pine is chosen. He looked at all of them too, but he really tried to choose just this one particular, most popular Chinese version to translate from. So there was this long gap between 1930 and 2012 where nobody wanted to touch this sutra in terms of like translating it. I think people studied it over the years, but not even so much studied it, I think. San Francisco Zen Center, for those 20 years, I never heard anyone give a class on this Lankavatara Sutra, even though it's said to be one of the most important foundational teachings of Zen tradition. And I think that may be because it's kind of difficult and kind of like there's all this stuff going on and it's all swirled up together. And it's not so neatly, methodically arranged. But the more I've been studying it for this class, the more I feel like there are themes that are woven through, all through, and then there's certain sections where it's really explains certain teachings very thoroughly and precisely. And so like this handout, maybe we'll use mainly these sections in 4 pages here for this 7-week series, we won't be able to read through the whole sutra, of course, in class. And we'll have another class series in the summer continuing with the sutra, so this is where we could start with this investigation into consciousness. A little background on how this sutra came to be. You know, it's amazing looking back, historians researching this stuff and how these things actually came to be, and the practice climate that they arose from. You know, and all the sutras are attributed to the Buddha, and historians would probably say, well, the Mahayana sutras maybe weren't the direct words of Shakyamuni Buddha, but as practitioners, we can take them up as words of the Buddha and study them in that way. And this Lankavatara Sutra is acknowledged by all Mahayana Buddhist traditions as like authentic scripture of the Buddha. Tibetan tradition quotes copiously from the sutra, as well as the Chinese Zen traditions. So Shakyamuni Buddha lived in 500 BC and taught many things. And then we have, you know, from a kind of historical perspective, we could say around maybe 100, year 100 of the Common Era, we had the Prajnaparamita Sutras, the first Mahayana Great Vehicle Sutras teaching emptiness, started arising around that time, radically cutting through all kinds of complicated ideas of earlier sutras, directly just pointing out the emptiness of all dharmas, ungraspability of everything. Not explaining so much why things are empty, how it is that we know things are empty, just all dharmas are marked by emptiness. Then we had various other sutras arising in connection with our study here. The Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra, so arose around 300, 350 in India, so a couple hundred years after the Prajnaparamita started getting popular. Some of you studied this Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra last year, the Sutra Unlocking the Mysteries, which we could say was like the first kind of scriptural basis of what became a Yogacara tradition, the yoga practice, the practice of union of all opposites. Also, sometimes Yogacara is actually called chitta-matra, or mind only. And some people might say they're not really exactly the same. But for our purposes, I'd say we can call them two different versions of this tradition. Certainly mind only is one of the main tenets of the Yogacara tradition. So the Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra talks about for the first time, talks about alaya, the storehouse consciousness, and eight consciousnesses in a very primitive form. When we studied that, the sutra doesn't say much, whereas this Lankavatara Sutra is going to really expand on and talk about how these eight work together. So alaya and the eight consciousnesses are a unique presentation of mind-only system, Yogacara system, not found in Prajnaparamita and other sutras. So, say around 350, this Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra appeared in the world, whether it was hidden, a dormant sutra left from Shakyamuni Buddha's lifetime, or whether it was written at that time, or channeled through the Buddha. We don't know how it arose, but it miraculously appeared in the world and taught many things. And first used this term, didn't actually use the term exactly mind only, but it used the term vijñāti matra, which means concept only, we could say, or conceptions only. Very similar, synonymous, really, I would say, with mind only. And then we have these two brothers, historically, Asanga and Vasubandhu, that lived around 350 also, maybe arose right around the same time as this sutra, and their whole teaching was based around the teachings of that Sangha Nirmojana Sutra. They're considered the founders of Yogacara, Asanga and Vasubandhu, his half-brother. And wrote many treatises commenting on that sutra and creatively expanding on it. And then it looks like around maybe 400, maybe during their life, but probably a little bit after their life, Asanga and Vasubandhu's life, this Lankavatara Sutra appeared in the world. It probably wasn't around during their life because they never mention it, and it's so similar to their thought that it would be strange if they didn't mention it and knew about it. And of course, once these sutras appear in India and become popular, there are all these, you know, teachers who are working with this stuff, get a hold of them and hear about them and comment on them. So it probably arose a little bit later.
And what else was happening in 350 besides the Sangha and Vasubandhu's teaching?
Well, the Sandhi Nirmojana Sutra appeared around that time. And I once made up this little timeline of when all the different sutras, according to historians, appeared. So other sutras like Vimalakirti Sutra were about 150 also. The Avatamsaka Sutra was earlier there. Maybe some of these longer sutras got put together over time. It may be that the complete Avatamsaka Sutra was around the same time as the Sandhi Nirmojana Sutra. And in particular, these three, Sandhi Nirmojana, that we studied last year, Unlocking the Mysteries, the Avatamsaka, or the Giant Flower Ornament Sutra, and this Lankavatara Sutra, are sometimes considered like the main scriptural foundations of Yogacara, or mind-only system. And also, we have this later trend called Tathagata Garbha, or Buddha Nature. It was a kind of maybe offshoot of Yogacara, and that all beings have or are this naturally pure, perfected Buddha awareness that's obscured by dualistic thought and so on, so we don't recognize it. That whole way of looking at ourselves arose a little bit after Yogacara as a kind of response to it or out of it. You could almost say it's like a whole other tradition, the Tathagata Garbha tradition. And that teaching appears in this sutra, this Lankavatara Sutra too. Like the Sandhi Nirmojana Sutra never mentions Buddha nature or Tathagata Garbha. So this sutra is really wonderful, I think, in that it's really gets into talking about all the basic Yogacara ideas and in a more clear and fully expounded way than earlier teachings. And it brings in and ties in together with it this whole teaching of Tathagata Garbha, the heart of the Tathagata, the Buddha nature. And so in the Buddha nature tradition, of the main scriptural foundations, we have the Lankavatara Sutra. They also mention the Flower Ornament Sutra has some teachings. Not all of its main teachings, but it is woven in there, at least seeds of the Buddha nature teaching. And also things like the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, it's a lot about Buddha nature, and the Tathagatagarbha Sutra, and there's others. So we have these, you know, different teaching presentations of how the mind works, what sentient beings are, what Buddhas are, of Yogacara, or mind only, and Tathagatagarbha. And each one has its different sutras and then different teachers commenting on them. But the Lankavatara bridges that gap and it kind of includes both. It's very all-inclusive in that way. So then around, probably around 400, this Lankavatara Sutra appeared in the world. So after Asanga and Vasubandhu, and definitely in central India, and then Buddhism, which was already in China at this time, and these sutras were being translated and brought over as they arose. It was around 450, it looks like, when the first Indian translators in China translated this Lankavatara Sutra. You can read in Red Pine's introduction, he talks more about the different translators. And then around, so that was around 450. And this was also the time that Bodhidharma was first coming from India to China to bring the Zen tradition. So Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism, had been around for centuries already in China, but this special new thing called Zen, Chan, was not yet there. There were more like sutra teachings going around in China that were similar maybe to Zen, but not the direct transmission outside the sutras that Bodhidharma brought, the direct experience of Buddhahood through just sitting, facing the wall, and the not knowing mind of Bodhidharma, this simple, directly transmitted, straightforward Buddha Dharma arrived around 500 in the Common Era. And that was the same time that our translator here, Gunabhadra, did the second translation of the Lankavatara Sutra. Seems like the first one kind of disappeared after it was translated, it got lost. Gunabhadra did the next one. Some other people did other further translations, like Bodhiruchi, around the same time. But the Gunabhadra version, the oldest one we have in Chinese, is the one that seems to have stuck in China, that Bodhidharma used, and the version that got passed on down to today. So most of the Chinese commentaries, later commentaries on the sutra, use this Gunabhadra one. And then we have the Tibetan versions are actually, one of them's from this Chinese Gunabhadra translation, so it won't really, there's nothing more in there that we're missing. And I think one of them is from one of the Sanskrit editions, but the Sanskrit ones that we currently have, like the D.T. Suzuki used, are modern, they're like, they don't go back before like the 18th century, I think. They're somewhat newer. So, and you know, historians can see from the type of language and all how that works. So to use Gunabhadra's Chinese translation might be like the oldest form that we have, the most original, unadulterated form. And that's what Red Pine's thinking was too. He's like, why go back to the Sanskrit if it's actually the versions we have are newer than the Chinese? So we do, it is interesting to go back and look at compare the Sanskrit and the different Chinese too, but this is what we have. And we have this story that Bodhidharma, this was like his main thing, you know, he just came from India with this one sutra and said, this is all you need to bring Zen from India to China, even though it's the transmission outside the sutras. Still, I bring this one sutra, the Lanka Vatara, and it's all you need. We have that story in our tradition. And we have this this very early, maybe one of the earliest records of Zen, this book called Zen Dawn. I think this might be from the Dunhuang Caves, discovered there, you know, when they found all these really old texts. This is called the Record of Teachers and Students of the Lanka. So what might be the earliest so-called Zen teaching is this story about these early Zen ancestors, and they're called the teachers and students of the Lanka, meaning of the Lanka Vatara Sutra. So it looks like our really early Zen tradition was like a Lanka Vatara tradition, actually. And this is a record of of these early ancestors, and it starts with early. They may be, I don't even know if they call it Chan at this point, but it's the Lanka Vatara lineage, and in fact, it's the ancestors that we know as Bodhidharma, Hueka, Tsongsan, Daoxin, Hongren, the first five ancestors that we still chant in our lineage, the first five ancestors of Zen in China, are this little lineage that they bring up here with their little stories about each one. But before Bodhidharma is listed, Gunabhadra, the translator of this version of the Lanka Vatara Sutra. Like, he's like really the first Zen ancestor in this version. And he's Gunabhadra Tripitaka means like he's a, when they use that title, that means like they're a scholar of the three baskets of Buddha's teaching, the sutras, the Vinaya, and the Abhidharma, as opposed to like Zen teacher Gunabhadra. It's the Gunabhadra Tripitaka. And he translated the Lanka Vatara Sutra, as this says. And then this is some like talk of Gunabhadra. So he says, in our land, in China, we have the correct teaching, but it is secret and not openly transmitted. Those who have an affinity with it and whose faculties are fully prepared meet good and wise people on the road who bestow it on them. If not for encounters with good and wise teachers, there would be no transmission from father to son, from mother to daughter. The Lanka Vatara Sutra says, the mind of the Buddhas is supreme. When the Dharma is bestowed in our teaching, where deluded states of mind do not arise, it is this. And then it's throughout this, Gunabhadra quotes the Lanka Vatara Sutra, and he also says a little more. Ultimately, the fruit of enlightenment can only be known for oneself with mind silent. So now this sounds a little more like Zen teaching, right? Enlightenment can be known only for oneself with silent mind. Mindless, we nurture the spirit. Without thought, we pacify the body. Without preoccupations, we sit in purity, preserving the fundamental and returning to the real. Our Dharma is secret and silent. It's not transmitted by common fools of shallow consciousness. Only people rich in merit and virtue can receive it and carry it out. And then he goes into some teachings like, if you do not understand, if you're not liberated, then the sixth consciousness possesses the seventh and the eighth. And so, without going into this teaching right now, this is the kind of thing that this Lanka Vatara Sutra is going to expound on with these eight consciousnesses. So then the next section is on, they call him Tripitaka Dharma Teacher Bodhidharma. He might be insulted to be called that. It was meditation master, Chan teacher, Bodhidharma, who took it up after Gunabhadra Tripitaka took it up. Took up the Dharma, took up the heart of the Lankavatara. And he, intent on clarifying the great vehicle, he traveled by sea to China. And Huayka served him for 5 years before he instructed him in these four practices that his Bodhidharma is known for, it's taught here. And he said to Huayka, there is the Lankavatara Sutra in four scrolls. If you practice according to it, you will naturally be liberated. Or, I have the Lankavatara Sutra in four scrolls, which I will give to you. This contains the essentials of the Tathagata's spiritual teachings and allows all beings to realize awakening. So then, there's, you know, some stories attributed to, or, you know, teachings attributed to Bodhidharma, and then it goes on to Huayka, who's also quoting the Lankavatara Sutra and other sutras, and the third, fourth, and fifth ancestors, and then this, then everything starts getting all, you know, the vines just start growing in all different directions, and also it seemed like by the time of the sixth ancestor, the Diamond Sutra was like kind of like took over in popularity. So it may be that these first five generations really like understood their practice through the Lankavatara Sutra, and then Huainong, the sixth ancestor, by his time, the focus shifted to the Diamond Sutra. And I think maybe it's Red Pine says something like, this may be because the Diamond Sutra is just easier to handle. You know, maybe to realize exactly what it's saying experientially is not really easier. In fact, it gives you less direction and specifics than the Lankavatara Sutra. But it's easier to study, maybe, because it just says that, like, nothing is graspable. Yeah. So, as Zen became more popular and more people practicing it, maybe they thought, for large groups of people, the Lankavatara Sutra is too tricky and too hard to explain it. So let's just use the Diamond Sutra as our main thing. So it may be too tricky for us, but let's see. There's a story that kind of represents this, right? In the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor, the famous poetry contest, right? Which you may recall the story about. The fifth ancestor's wanting to pass on his dharma, and he asks everybody who's there to write a poem expressing their understanding. And the head monk writes a poem, and then Huainong, the illiterate woodcutter, rice pounder, hears about it and writes his own. And that was this whole thing about how the Southern School began with the Sixth Ancestor and so on. There's a little description in the Platform Sutra about when the head monk wrote the poem, he said, I don't want people to know that I wrote it because they might not think it's good. So I'll write it on the, did he say he'd write it on the wall? Is that how it worked?
Yes.
And did he have, somehow what was happening was there was this commission, a painter's commission to paint scenes from the Lankavatara Sutra?
Yeah.
Is that how it goes? On the corridor wall.
And he painted it white to get ready for the painter.
Okay. So it wasn't because of the poem that they painted it white.
No.
They got, maybe the wall was just needed priming, right?
Yeah.
So it was an old chipped paint wall, so they painted it right, to get ready to paint scenes of the Lankavatara Sutra. But before they could do it, this head monk wrote his poem, his Zen poem on that wall about polishing the mirror. And then Hui Nong said, ask somebody else to put his poem up there next to it. So about that there's no mirror to polish. It's kind of the Diamond Sutra's theme. There's no mirrors to polish. There's no anything to do anything about. Whereas you could say this Lankavatara Sutra may be more a little bit about mirror polishing. It would also say ultimately there's no mirror to polish, but before it says that, or while it's saying that, it's also saying there's some practices that you can do. Like there's some dualistic dust on the mirror, and there's, by studying how the mind works, we can let it go. It's kind of like polishing it. But those scenes, because of this Diamond Sutra orientation, the Lankavatara scenes never got painted on the walls there. So that was that generation of the fifth and sixth ancestor in China, we could say, it was symbolically then shifted to this focus on the Diamond Sutra. And of course, also the fifth ancestor, when transmitting the Dharma to the sixth in the middle of the night, taught him the Diamond Sutra, as it says in the Platform Sutra. So maybe from then on, the Lankavatara Sutra became studied less and less, although it was always kept alive in China and often appears quoted by Zen teachers. So that's a little background on the time it arose, the context in which it arose. Yogacara tradition had already emerged, but the sutra came up in that same spirit. And why we take it up as Bodhidharma's main teaching, even though it's a little challenging. It's the birth of our school. We have these personal connection to it in that way as Zen practitioners, as students of Bodhidharma. So the Lankavatara Sutra. Lanka means probably Sri Lanka. It's about some particular place. And it looks like it means, Sri means like holy Lanka, which is called Ceylon for a while. I think they now call it Sri Lanka again.
Yeah.
They go back to their historical name. That big island off of southern India. And avatara means to descend into, like we have in the Hindu tradition, avatars are like a living saint is like an avatar of some deity, maybe, or of a past saint. They're like almost like an incarnation. But literally, avatar means to descend into or to enter into. So that's like, you know, some deity has like descended onto earth in this form of an avatar, or the deity has descended into this person. A light descend or enter into. We have like the Madhyamaka Avatara is a text by Chandrakirti that's often translated as entry into the middle way. So it can just mean that, plain and simple, entering into something. So entering into Lanka, or descent into Lanka, or alighting on Lanka, which is where the Buddha landed to teach this sutra. And so Red Pine says some things like, he translated the Heart and Diamond Sutra. He puts it like, the Diamond Sutra teaches detachment from dharmas like phenomena, mental and physical phenomena. Diamond Sutra teaches detachment from phenomena. Heart Sutra teaches the emptiness of phenomena. And the Lankavatara teaches the non-projection of phenomena. So I don't know if the heart and Diamond Sutras are really that different, but detachment and emptiness are similar. They're all three similar, but it's a little different to say, instead of just saying all dharmas are marked by emptiness, we say all dharmas are projections of mind. That's the kind of focus of this sutra. And Red Pine also says that the two main themes he feels like in the sutra are the direct personal experience that it's emphasizing, and that all dharmas are projections of mind, or mind only. And those two go together. But he feels like the reason that the Zen ancestors honored it so much is this over and over again emphasizing direct personal experience of suchness, of Buddha mind, that a lot of other sutras, it's implied, you could say, but they don't keep bringing that back in again and again. He also says, Red Pine, that the sutras like Zen tea in a Yogacara cup. Yogacara is this, the Indian tradition of mind only. That's the container for which to hear all these teachings. That's the traditional presentation is in the sutra. But what's in it is like the Zen tea that we have to actually taste directly ourselves. And just that slight bitter taste on the tongue of Zen tea. So, first of all, before we jump right into the sutra itself, just so I know, you're probably already convinced that that Zen is closely related to Yogacara or mind only. It's something that I bring up a lot, and I think it's many of teachings are really grow out of this Yogacara tradition. So that's why I feel it's really wonderful to look back at the roots of where this comes from. But we have Dogen saying in mind itself is Buddha, that fascicle we studied last year, some of us. Dogen says, what Buddhas and ancestors have maintained without exception is mind itself is Buddha. However, this particular expression was not known in India. It was first heard in China. Many students misunderstand this teaching because they do not examine it thoroughly. Ignorant people think that the thoughts and awareness of ordinary beings who have not aroused the way-seeking mind are already Buddhas. Thoughts and awareness of ordinary beings are already Buddha thoughts. They think in this way because they've not yet met an authentic teacher. So then he goes on to make these distinctions between ordinary thoughts and Buddha thoughts, which is, there's a lot that could be said, which we'll get into. And Dogen says, the mind that has been authentically transmitted is one mind is all things are one mind. Thus, an ancient Zen teacher said, if you realize this mind, there's not an inch of land left on earth. So this would be kind of a Zen way of talking about mind only. When you realize this mind, then there's not an inch of land left on earth, because what seems to be inches and feet, yards and miles of land on earth are actually mind. So there's no land left on earth. It's all becomes mind, earth. Know that when you realize this mind, the entire sky collapses and the whole earth explodes. Or if you realize this mind, the earth raises its surface by 3 inches. This is Dogen doing his thing now. He says, the ancient Zen teachers Yangshan and Guishan said, "What is the wondrous clear mind? I say it's mountains, rivers, and earth, sun, moon, and stars." So Dogen says, "Thus we know that the mind is mountains, rivers, and earth. The mind is sun, moon, and stars. What is said here is not more, not less." But Dogen says many things like this, but that's an example of how he's saying mind is mountains, rivers, and earth, sun, moon, and stars. Those are mind. So now, to get into this sutra, first, we might ask, well, what, you know, as you're getting the gist, and I think many of you know this teaching of mind only, we really say that what appears to be the external world is projections of mind. What's the point of studying how that's so? Why would we want to examine that over and over again and more deeply? Or why would we want to see that all phenomena are empty, or all phenomena are, what is it, the Diamond Sutra version, are, if the heart sutra, what's that?
Detached,
yeah. Why would we want to detach from all phenomena? You probably know, but does anyone, would anyone say, why would, what's the main purpose we would want to understand deeply how all phenomena are actually projections of mind? Yeah.
Well, it would seem that we suffer as a result of imputing permanence and identity to these things, and that seems to come natural from, say, stubbing the toe on one's bedpost. But our complaining or our narration about that, it really is what we think happened. So if we can clearly see moment by moment that our mind is essentially nominating virtual realities to us, we don't have to invest in it in a way that causes suffering.
Yeah. Does that make sense to people? That's the basic idea. And you could say, well, yeah, of course, we can see how our gross projections, Red Pine uses this word projection a lot for this term vikalpa or parikalpa. Some other people might say discrimination or imputation or imagination. He likes to use projection, which is has a kind of modern psychological twist in there too, right? Because we want to get over our projections, our false projections, like onto people who we think they really are and so on. And the things of the world, we believe things are the way we project them to be, and therefore we grasp them as our version of them and as really real and substantial and like permanent, as you said, and therefore we suffer. So you could say the underlying proposition to begin the whole study is that suffering, from a Yogacara point of view, that suffering or discontent of sentient beings arises from believing that the projections of our mind are actually, maybe we could say, external to mind. Is how that unique system would say it. Not just that the projections really exist, that is part of it too, but it's the duality, the belief that the external world, by external we mean external or outside the mind that's projecting. We believe that things are separate from the mind. That's duality, right? Subject-object duality.
So could we say that suffering is like a smoke alarm that tells us that we are abusing our Buddha nature?
A smoke. Yeah, we could say that. Suffering is like a smoke alarm that tells us we're abusing our Buddha nature, or disregarding our Buddha nature, ignoring our Buddha nature, obscuring our Buddha
nature.
Not
using our Buddha nature.
Not freely using and being used by our Buddha nature. Suffering, so it's, we're looking at suffering and the suffering we cause to ourselves and others as arising from the belief that the things of the world, and this includes, you know, mental, physical, all kinds of phenomena, are actually truly exist separate from, outside of, external to the mind that's projecting them. That belief in that dualistic separation is the source of suffering, according to Yogacara. Other Buddhist schools would say suffering arises from basic ignorance, but they might define that basic ignorance in slightly different ways. So this is a unique mind-only view. And I think that was kind of simple to say and maybe somewhat simple to understand, but I think we should keep coming back to this point again and again, that the whole point of this is about relief of suffering for ourselves and others, also that so that great compassion can arise for others who believe in separation. And as we get into the details, not lose sight of that this is the point. And, you know, apply it and see how we can actually see if it actually makes sense to open to it to large degree or small degree and deepen our opening to mind only as we continue through this study. So to begin the sutra, at the beginning, it's on this handout and in the book where you can listen along to. Chapter 1 is King Ravana's request. Thus have I heard. All Buddha sutras begin. Once the Bhagavan, the Blessed One, was staying in the South Seas on the peaks of Sri Lanka in a place adorned by countless jewels and flowers. In addition to an assembly of great monks, he was also joined by a host of great bodhisattvas from other Buddha lands, led by Mahamati, Bodhisattva Mahasattva. They were masters of every kind of samadhi, spiritual power, and psychic ability, and were the recipients of the blessings of countless Buddhas. Skilled in the knowledge that external objects are perceptions of one's own mind, this term, svacittadrishya, they had opened the doors of liberation for beings of every mental capacity and were thoroughly versed in the five dharmas, the three modes of reality, the eight forms of consciousness, and the two kinds of no-self. So that's the first paragraphs of the sutra. And as I understand it, the Gunabhadra translation jumps right from there to the beginning of the second chapter. It skips this whole long interaction with Ravana, the yaksha or rakshasa king. And, but other versions in these other translations include this section. But first of all, this part here, it's a nice summary of the whole sutra to come. For one thing, these bodhisattvas in attendance, they're skilled in the knowledge that external objects are perceptions of one's own mind. That's mind only.
Are what, perceptions of one's?
Yeah, perceptions. Skilled in the knowledge that external objects, what we call external objects, are actually perceptions of one's own mind. Sva Chitta Drishya. Sva means like own or self. Chitta is mind. And Drishya is like the object of drishti. People might know the term drishti means like view. A view, like, could mean seeing, but view or seeing. So then the object of a drishti is a drishya. In other words, the object of, that we could call it the seen, or the discerned, or the apprehended, or the perceived, or even the experienced. So, own mind experienced, own mind perceived, is svacitta drishya. And so these bodhisattvas are skilled in that. And they had opened the doors of liberations for beings of every mental capacity. Means they were great bodhisattvas, so they were opening doors of liberation for others. Very important. They're helping others become free of belief and projections. And then they were thoroughly versed in these different categories. And this is what the sutra is going to go through, and I think is a nice way for us to look at approaching the sutra. These five dharmas, you can read them: appearance, name, projection, correct knowledge, suchness. We'll actually take that up as part of our study because it appears throughout the sutra. The three modes of reality, sometimes called the three natures. The imagined, dependent, and perfect nature is very important Yogacara teaching that is in the sutra. The eight forms of consciousness are the five sense consciousnesses, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body. Conceptual mental consciousness is the sixth consciousness. Will, or what he translates as will or self-identity, is called manas, the seventh consciousness. And then repository, or storehouse consciousness, alaya. So these eight consciousnesses, most of this handout is about that topic. Like the first in this class to take up how these consciousnesses work together. And then two kinds of no-self, sentient beings and all other phenomena, is a Mahayana teaching, because early pre-Mahayana teachings said people have no self, but they don't say that objects have no self. That would be really radical. But the Mahayana gets that radical, and it says, and it keeps the distinction though. It says there's the selflessness of a person, or the identitylessness of a person, but also identitylessness of all dharmas, which is the same as their emptiness. So we call that two kinds of no self. Yes?
I was reading today, is it your understanding that apparently arahats realize the selflessness of persons, but not the selflessness of phenomena?
That's right, yep. That's the difference between an arahat and a great vehicle, Buddha, or a great bodhisattva. Exactly. Some people would even say that's, you know, if you, that's the main distinction between the small vehicle and the great vehicle, in terms of the great vehicle distinction. What's the difference really between those? Some people might say it's just the matter of, this might sound like a really small technical point, but it's just that in the small vehicle, the culmination of the practice is the realization of no personal identity, fixed self identity. And the Mahayana just blows that up into all, the entire world is empty of any fixed self. People might say, that's just, well, so, that doesn't seem like that big a distinction. But the implications might be very big. Partly because the Mahayana is based on great compassion, and for great compassion to reach everywhere completely in an unhindered way, the view has to be like opened even wider. All dharmas are marked by emptiness, and therefore we're willing to meet all kinds of suffering beings in difficult situations through knowing that they're not really what we think they are, when we're willing to go there. That would be one implication for bodhisattvas, realizing emptiness of everything.
Well, yeah, because without that then we would have a kind of unique selfhood that is not selfhood compared to everything else. But if we go to this place of mind only, then the condition of our mind, if you will, conditions all beings. So we have to purify our view of all beings. And this is why a bodhisattva does what he does for the sake of all beings. He has to.
Yeah. I mean, arhats really do realize no individual self.
I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But they're selfish in that.
How's that?
Because if they say there's no selfhood in me, but everything else, maybe there is, that it really separates them as a kind of self.
Yeah, I guess you could say it like that. I mean, they would also see that all sentient beings also have no abiding self, that they're just all these walking sets of five skandhas. They could see that when they see it in themselves, they see it in others. But they're, so I don't know, to say that they're selfish, maybe I would say maybe going a little far, but that their compassion isn't completely, you know, that arhat's compassion may not be completely unhindered. But if, I think to call them self, calling arhat selfish might be going a little far.
Six is one, half a
dozen. They're definitely great beings.
And any establishment of one's uniqueness compared to everything else, even if it's nothing, yes, identifies a boundary.
Yeah. Any other questions? Yes.
I have a question. Just in approaching this sutra or any sutra, what would you suggest as to how to read it? You know, I know there's a lot of footnotes in here, and if I keep going back to the footnotes, I kind of lose the rhythm, and I'm kind of, kind of, you know, going along with a nice rhythm of things, and it's enjoying the pictures that I'm seeing and stuff like that.
Yeah, you don't have to read the footnotes.
Yeah.
I mean, you could do different ways. If you want to really get into studying it, you could just read through without the footnotes and just get the feeling for it, and then you could go back and read it with the footnotes. Or you could stop along the way, just read one sentence at a time, and the footnote, stop and just contemplate the sentence for a while, and then go on to the next. I think whatever people's inclinations are to engage with it, I think are good. Fixed way.
The teaching will just kind of come into me without trying to.
Sometimes it's like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The foggy day theory.
You know, we have this teaching that I often like to bring up when studying sutras, especially, and these kind of like maybe difficult and kind of conceptual models and stuff, that these three types of wisdom, you know, the wisdom from hearing, and we include reading with that, means just the conceptual ideas. And it's a kind of, this is an early Buddhist teaching, that it's a kind of prajna, a kind of wisdom, when you just hear, like the words, you know, they were skilled in the knowledge that external objects are perceptions of one's own mind. Like, whether or not we like know exactly what that means or we believe it or not, just to actually get the words down, clarify the words. Yeah, okay, I hear that. Like, a wisdom actually comes in there. It's like, yeah, it just, if we're just open, it just comes in. And then the second type of wisdom is the wisdom from reflecting on those teachings, hearing, after having heard them, we turn them around in the mind and contemplate, like, how do they make sense or not? And so I think if we just listen and don't actually mentally engage with in a way that, like, question it, which is great in a class because we can bring up how we question it and turn it around with different people's views and so on, then the wisdom is, that's a deeper kind of wisdom, the wisdom from reflecting on, turning around. And then the final, third kind of wisdom is through meditative cultivation, or actually becoming the teaching itself. And that would be like drinking the Zen tea from the Yogacara cup, to just directly realize that the external world is not separate from mind, beyond the concepts of it. So that's a kind of non-conceptual wisdom, final wisdom. And all three of these can work together. And so in sutra study, we might actually say that probably that direct, non-conceptual wisdom around all objects being projections of one's own mind might not dawn on us to the full extent without having conceptually understood the teachings first. Now, it might. Some people like just sit in zazen and they have that experience like that, maybe, and they haven't heard it put quite that way before, but they kind of start opening to that because the mind's getting more and more non-conceptual when we're sitting. But then they might just feel like, oh, I feel really relaxed and open now and less caught up in this, in the external world. That's nice, but they might not equate that with having kind of started to touch on and open to mind only. Right? So we have these, by studying and reflecting on the conceptual teachings, then if it happens in zazen, we have this context for it, which might be really helpful, because then you can work it more. You're like, okay, we're starting to touch on it, and maybe you can direct the mind slightly deeper into it if you're like, come upon it in a context. We can talk about these things further, how we might meditate on these kind of things. Yes?
Curious, because I know that the earlier teachings, the Theravadan tradition, partly the reason that there were certain schools that just kind of stayed that way was because there was an act of trying to suppress Buddhism in India. And when was that? And then kind of these other teachings went out to other countries that were affected by that. And
that
was kind of developed into the Mahayana.
I'm not sure, but it seemed like Mahayana Buddhism was going strong in India by the 8th and 9th century. I think people like Chandrakirti and Shantideva were these great Indian Mahayana poetic writers, and Nalanda University was thriving. So it may be that around the year 1000 or maybe before that, I don't know what happened when... I think there were some big Muslim invasions, right, that really that kind of wiped out Indian Buddhism up to today, but it had already spread to China and Tibet.
Because Sri Lanka was one of the places where the Theravadan tradition survived.
Because it's an island.
All of Southeast Asia.
Yeah, there's some theories here too about how why did they choose Sri Lanka as the setting for the sutra, and maybe Red Pine talks about this some, that there was there's a king in India that's brought up here who had a relative in Sri Lanka. There might have been some political stuff going on. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Seems to have been added about 300 years later,
mm-hmm.
in part as a political response to give some credence to Mahayana on what happened in Theravadan territory.
Yeah.
There was some animosity.
And also bringing in Hindu teachings, this Ravana, the Rakshasa, I think, was a, as we talked about in one talk, it appears in the Mahabharata. I think so, yeah. Yeah, and so they're weaving in this Hindu deity that hardly ever appears in Buddhist texts, and that's the setting for, he's the one who's inviting the Buddha to teach the sutra, this ten-headed creature.
The Dragon King?
Maybe he's called a dragon king at some point.
Serpent king.
Ravana? He might have been in it.
He was expounding the Dharma for 7 days in the palace of Sagara, the serpent.
Oh, okay. He just used the palace. The serpent king. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in the first chapter, the after this part we just read, then King Ravana comes in his flower-decked chariot and goes to the Buddha and invites him to teach. And then there's all these verses praising the Buddha, inviting the Buddha to teach this sutra, which has been taught in past eons and will be taught in the future. And now it's time to teach it now. It's like this timeless event. And the Buddha praises Ravana for inviting him to teach. And so it's basically setting up this whole setting here. And then Mahamati, whose name means, Mati's like intelligence or intellect. So great intelligence, you could say, is the questioner throughout the rest of the sutra after this.
He's a bodhisattva.
He's a bodhisattva, mahasattva. And maybe he knows the answers to all the questions already, but he's just the interlocutor, like the... Yeah. Just getting the Buddha to respond to all these questions. So he comes in here and... and Ravana asks questions and... the Buddha responds, and then we get to chapter 2, which is here called Mahamati's questions. And Mahamati asks these, like, 108 questions, and they're really random questions. He just, like, throws them all out there, just this whole huge string, and then the Buddha goes to answer them all. It's basically about, it's kind of, it sounds like Prajnaparamita. It's like, these things neither exist nor they don't exist. There's these long lists. And as Red Pine says, you know, he has trouble counting exactly 108, but he says, but it's enough. He asks enough questions. Yeah, it's a sacred number. There's some funny questions you can read. It's just a list of all these. You can get a sense of Indian culture of the time by these questions, but it's pages of them and their answers. And I think this is a part that we can skip discussing. And then these, you know, the Buddha says, a statement about birth is about no birth. A statement about permanence is about no permanence. And he goes through all of these answers about, you know, kind of like the Heart Sutra, right? Pages of just listing these different terms and then saying they're actually about not that. Very much like the Heart Sutra. And then we get up to chapter, section 4. When Mahamati starts to ask about consciousness, and it gets into the main topics of the sutra. This is all kind of just an overview, background of where, how this arose, why we study it, a little how to study it, and just to bring up a kind of like an experiment we might try as a kind of opening to mind. We haven't gotten into the details of mind only yet here, but just to bring up an example that we might contemplate for the next week. For me, this seems to be a helpful one. And when we hear about this topic that, well, that really the external world is really just projections of mind, when we first hear that, we can start to really doubt that. It's a kind of a fun idea, but like, really? So this example is, we might be able to open to this more. And for those who are inclined towards modern science, I think it comes from there. So we might... open to it more because of that. And it's just talking about visual consciousness, visual experience. So my understanding, and biologists, scientists could correct me, but my current understanding is like the way visual consciousness works is like there's these rods and cones on the back of the retina, at the back of the eyeball, right? And they are like color receptors. We might call that like the gross sense faculty or sense organ in modern times, or like might be these rods and cones. They're like the material that receives light and is going to transform that into like visual awareness, consciousness. So light comes in from the so-called external world, right? And it's reflected back there. And then scientists might say the brain. In Buddhism, there's actually they never talk about the brain, because mind is not the same. Brain is like a physical organ. Mind is an unlocatable awareness, right? But we might say something in the brain, or we might say the mind, flips over this image because it's projected upside down, right? Because the way the light rays come through the lens of the eye, it's projected upside down, and the brain turns it right side up so that we can walk straight without going upside down. And I've heard, maybe you've heard about this experiment where they gave somebody mirror glasses, and that basically you could make glasses that turn the world upside down when you look through them. And they put them on this person as an experiment to see what would the brain do. And so at first it was like pretty hard, right, to get around, and like you have to like figure out how to move the opposite way than you would think. The right arm's the left arm, and upside's the right side. And I forget how long it took, but not that long. I think a couple of weeks, was it? Maybe less. When the brain actually turned the image over to just like it does with a normal image, to make it more workable. And then you got used to that, so you could, you know, with these glasses, everything was normal. And then they took the glasses off, and it was like, uh-oh, now it's all upside down again. What if it doesn't come back? But sure enough, the brain shortly reinterpreted the image and turned it right side up again. This example is a kind of like a mind-only experiment that was done. We could say what we're seeing, we see an object here, is actually, this is like colors on the rods and cones on the organ there, and then Buddhism would say there's a visual consciousness, an eye consciousness, that's transforming those like physical colors into mental awareness. And how exactly that happens, people have been fascinated about for a long time, and the different Buddhist schools tell different stories. But can we open to, when we're looking at an object here, that actually we're not really seeing, strictly speaking, we're not really seeing the external object, right? Conventionally speaking, we say, yeah, we see a book, but what are we really seeing? Even according to science, right? Aren't we actually seeing an image on the back of the retina that has been constructed and actually reversed upside down and then transformed into what we call the world? And we're so used to doing that from birth onwards that we actually, it's like really, it's 3D, right? It's great. It's like virtual reality, this world. But yes.
There's actually one much easier experiment that everyone can do at home. It's quite amazing. If you put a pendulum up that is on two strings with something very like a red ball, and it swings, and you look at it, and of course it swings in only one line, and then you cover one of your eyes with sunglasses, but only one of your eyes, the pendulum will start making an ellipse. It's because the processing on the covered eye is slower, and so your brain will start to see two points. Very, very, very little distant from each other, but because the brain thinks that cannot be,
it's going to see the cross section.
Well, so you don't completely cover, but you just like a tinted sunglasses.
Yeah.
Oh.
And you will see an ellipse, and you will see how small reality is.
That's a great example. And the sutra mentions many classical Indian examples, like a circle of fire. It mentions all things are like this, meaning like you take a fire on the end of a stick at night and it looks like a circle, but we know there's not really a circle of fire. So they're optical illusions. But the nice one about this contemplation of how visual consciousness works is it's like you don't even have to do anything particular to like alter your perceptual ability. It's like the way we normally see is this funny thing, right? Our just normal visual experience is not, you know, you have to really kind of think about it. This would be an example, right? Almost like you're taking on the two earlier kinds of wisdom. You can't just say, oh yeah, it's on the back of my retina. You have to almost like imagine the reality the way we've heard about it according to science, say. Imagine that we're seeing on the back and then start to say, and really that is how they say, really. So like, you mean it's really not out here? So I don't know if you, when you play with that as a, you know, open to that, how that works, if it starts to affect your confidence in externality in a good way.
There have been these pictures on the internet that are black and white with three colored dots in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
For example, a person.
Mm-hmm.
And they ask you to look at those three dots, at the red dot, for quite some time, and then to blink your eyes. And I don't understand how, but the picture seems to be color now. The mind fills in a lot of the things we actually don't see.
Yeah.
Also a very interesting, that's on YouTube, and it shows six people playing basketball, and people are asked to count how often the balls change hands. And in the middle of the video, which is maybe 20, 30 seconds long, there's a man in a gorilla suit that walks into the middle of the picture, beats his chest, and walks off. And the majority of the people don't see him because they count the ball.
Yep.
Part of that was to make the argument of being able to multitask is not really a reality. The brain doesn't work that way.
I know there's to discredit eyewitness statements during accidents.
Our minds are limited, and I think these interesting optical illusions and things are great examples to play with, where you can explore and bring in more things we can do to test the reality of our mind's constructions. But you can do that, and with visual consciousness, and also with all the different senses, right? Sounds, you can take, like, all the scientific explanations for sounds are like a vibration on the eardrum and these little bones moving in there, right? And so, are you hearing my voice out here right now? Or is the sound consciousness actually just perceiving some movement of these little tiny bones in here? Again, we would say that's what we're really hearing. It's not that it's not related. Now you could say, with all these sensory examples, we'd say, well, but there really are the colors out there that are, even though we're not seeing them, and that's, you know, is part of it. We could get into discussing that. But I think one nice way to look at mind only in general is like, in terms of our experience, we can get into a lot of ontological arguments about, is there really an external world that's the basis of our experience or not? And even within this mind-only tradition, there's a lot of argument, and people debate well, is the tradition really saying that, that there's nothing that's the basis? And in fact, that most people do agree that is what it's saying. But without, and that's where most of us, I think, would come down and say, no, that's going too far. But even if we don't go that far, I think a nice way to look at mind only, if you don't want to go that far, is to just say, in our experience, isn't it true that everything we experience is actually a mental projection? Like the colors on the back of the eyeball. Well, there might be colors out there, but we'll never experience the colors themselves. We're just going to experience the rods and cones, you know. So we, and in a way, it's like, does it even matter if they're out there? We might ask. Now, again, there might be reasons for the tradition saying, no, you really have to investigate how there is no basis for them, because otherwise our grasping tendency will try to say, but let's try to get a hold of that, the real color out there. But however far we take this, we'll never be able to experience an actual external color.
We could also just say that that question is not answerable with this mind.
We could say that, but then we could, you know, some maybe religious people might say, but there's scriptural basis for it, because the Buddha says that.
But then we offer them tea.
Yeah.
And cookies.
Maybe there is, I don't know, basis, could this mind tell or not? I don't know. It might be able to be possible, not through our ordinary consciousness, but there might be like a kind of Buddha awareness.
It's like asking a fish if there's such a thing as air. Mm-hmm. The fish cannot answer that question.
A fish can't, but if the fish was like became Buddha, they might be able to.
Well, we can discuss that another time.
We could become Buddha and see.
It swims through the dragon gate.
And also, there's interesting that there's some reasonings there that the, you know, so that we don't just have to rely on somebody's word. There's almost like proofs that we might find like that they don't hold up, but maybe we can get into some of them. Kind of like logical proofs that you could, through logic, discern that there really couldn't be any external basis for the projections. But that takes a lot of work to go through that logical route, but maybe worth it. Anyway, yes?
So I'm just thinking about, like, we're all seeing you and hearing you.
Yeah.
How does that...
About the basis,
yeah.
But you're, well, for one thing, the way you're all seeing and hearing me, we could all easily see that it's all slightly different, right?
Yeah.
Just the angle where you're sitting, you see a different version of me. So in that way, just in the most basic way, you could say each person's visual image of me is their own projected vision, because you can't put your eyeballs in exactly the same place as another person. So in that way, it would... On the simplest way, we could say, yeah, there's not a certain angle of me that's like the true angle. It's like there is no true visual image of Kokyo, right? It's like it's going to be different for everybody depending where they're sitting. And then this question is about whether this is the deeper question that we may or may not even need to get into is. Is there an actual basis for everybody's projections? Is there something here that's the basis for everyone's projections? Something maybe we could say physical. Is there a material basis that's really here that everyone's projecting onto? In some ways, we maybe say it doesn't matter that much. We really have to notice how we're projecting our own unique Kokyos from, you know, everybody's perspective. But it does, you know, this is the difficult part of the tradition says there's actually the basis that we project that onto, we call like the other dependent, the dependently arisen basis is an ungraspable thing. And actually that too is created by mind. That's where it gets really hard to take.
Yeah, because if we're all seeing the same
person, because it's collective. It's kind of complicated story, how it works. But it's not individual at that point, right? It's a collectively created basis for projection. And, we're a little bit out of time, but you can just close with this image to start contemplating this. Could there be no fixed external basis? It's just the way that different species of sentient beings perceive this body, for example. Like all humans share a certain collective karma, you could say, a collective kind of consciousness, and that we all see me as a human being and probably like male and, you know, wearing some kind of religious clothing or something like that. Most of us could agree on it. But a different species, like a cat, they'd still see some objective thing, but they wouldn't have all that stuff that we all agree and say, no, there really is, like, you know, this really is like a Zen Rakasu or something. The cat wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't see it that way. Would they see the same similar colors and something? Maybe, but then, you know, we could start to look even deeper, like, how do people see?
Or a bee, or a spider,
yeah,
or a fish.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question arises, well, which perception or which experience is the real one?
Yeah. Yeah, and of course there's not.
Yeah,
we are kind of human-centered, so we think that's more like reality. But these are, so let's, you can save some thoughts for next week, because this is time. But you can see how it can get to be a very interesting discussion about what is reality from the mind-only point of view, and to keep grounding that in the purpose of this, is to be free from grasping a fixed reality, and therefore be open to all beings and the present arising. May all beings be free from the suffering of grasping an externally projected world, and therefore be able to help all beings become free in such a way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. Surpassable, I vow.